This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'm going to basically to go on four great stages. The first is a genealogy of instability, just to use this wonderful word used by Barbara this morning. Then I move to the what I call the strategies of self-assertion in film. I want to speak a little bit third stage on I and low definition. And finally, my point is that instead of speaking of being cinema, we have to think that cinema has to remain cinema or to become cinema now. I want to start from a strange product that started to circulate in the networks in 2010. Sorry, I stop it. It seems to me a good starting point. This is not only a very, it's unusual and very funny film. The Star Wars, the original, has been cut in 15-second segments, and then the fan has been asked to remake just the segment they wanted, and the producer just put together the best segment remade. It's not only an interesting, a fan product, and Francesca Cappa explained to us what is the fan culture. This today is very well. And it seems to me that this is a real product that is challenging our idea about what a movie is and what cinema is. Is just a remake or is a new idea of cinema? Is a celebration of the past or a foreseeing of the future, of what in the future could be cinema? Is a burial or a resurrection? In other words, it seems to me that this film, in its entirety, is really challenging the question like Barbara this morning surfaced, the contrast between stability and instability, or better, also, the contrast between the essential cinematic and intermediated cinema. The challenge is, to me, based basically on five beyond that this product try to foreground. The first is the beyond the singularity of a work. There is a strange relation between this film, of course, this, the irony of the title, Uncut, but is not the original in its original version. On the contrary, is on one side we need to have in mind George Lucas' film, but on the other side is the complete autonomy of this work. Is on one side totally in depth, but on the other not a remake like an adaptation or reversal like a parody. It's something which is connected with the original in a way which is typical of the connection in a network with many possible points. Beyond the singularity of the work in the sense that is no more a film that I can take as such, no more a film that I can reduce or put into this field of cinema, but I have to take in mind a larger network of discourses. Beyond a model of production and consumption, the fan culture, again, and the role of the fan culture as, for example, has been explored by John Caldwell in his work. beyond the borders of a text, in the sense that if you go on the website, we do not have time, but it's really, if you want, you can do easily. If you go on the website of Star Wars Uncut, you just not have the opportunity to watch this film. In the homepage, you can find comments, projects, the sequences, the 15-second sequences that have not been chosen by the producer, but you can choose them, and you can remake your own film if you want. The announcements, the theatrical releases, etc., etc., etc. And it will be clear in a second, these discourses are not outside the text. They are inside. Star Wars Uncut is not just the movie I started to show you, but is the entire monumental set of discourses. Is the project, the development of the project, the unstable state of the text. And finally, is beyond the indexical, in the sense that, in a certain sense, it will be clear, I guess, clearer in a second, is that it tries to deal with a new semiotic entity. In order to understand this beyond, I want to risk a little genealogy of the expansion or the instability. Of course, if we look back, especially to the history of early film theories, as I'm used to do, it's not usual to understand or to feel that cinema has been perceived at the beginning as a stable, unified, well-defined field. The early theorists, starting from Canudo, for example, or from Luciani, or Teige, which is an impressive text by Teige on the topic, they perceive cinema, basically, as a very open field, in which, at the same time, we have a new means of expression, but also the final stage of other means of expression, and also, that's the third element, an impulse for other media to develop differently their own path. That is quite clear in Teige, for example, in which cinema is essentially conceived as a modern medium and is totally put together with a number, I mean, extremely, is say cinema as is on development on the window of the train. This is the final expansion of the movies. In this genealogy of expansion, of course, that I'm not able to retrace completely, I have no time. A capital passage is Gene Youngblood and his expanded cinema. I reread quite recently in the last month Gene Youngblood's book. It's chaotic, not easy to read. But in attempt to prepare my lecture here, I was struck basically in a sort of, philological background, it's possible to find really five kind of expansion in this book. The first is the expansion of film technology and film's language. The sentence you can read, expanded cinema is the only aesthetic language suited to the post-industrial, post-literary, post-made, man-made environment with its multidimensional, simul-sensory network of information sources. The great idea of Youngblood, as maybe someone of you remembers, is that cinema must expand, because we are living a pre-cybernetic era in which the environment is basically a mediated environment, and film is one of these elements of the environment. And that means that instead of just having a dialogue with the old media like theater and literature, he has to have a strong dialogue with the environment in which film lives. And the expansion of film technology and language is totally connected with this, the perception of this environment. And of course, he quotes many filmmakers of its age, and you find here Michael Snow, just a frame of wavelength, which is one of the film he quotes. The second expansion is the expansion of the presence of cinema in the everyday. This short sentence: for the first time in history, every human now has the ability to capture, preserve, and interpret those aspects of the living present that are meaningful to him. Of course, he has in mind also this accessibility of the technologies, the accessibility of the portapack that he quotes at one point, but he has in mind, in a general sense, the idea that the light technologies made possible for everybody to become a filmmaker. Sorry. Oh, my gosh, what happens? Sorry. Apologize, but the expansion of what he calls the spectator's feedback, in the sense that what he finds is the possibility of a stronger connection between the consumers and the producers. And the idea that this dialogue is really enhancing the presence of cinema. He has in mind, of course, not just the lightness of technology, but the involvement of special spectators. It's not the same year, so I used another image, but the idea of the new climate around the film consumption. There is an expansion in the exchanges with other media. To explore new dimensions of awareness requires new technological extensions. Just as the term man is coming to mean man, plant, machine, so the definition of cinema must be expanded to include videotronics, computer science, atomic light. What he quotes is, for example, the connection between film and theater. Caroli Schneemann, it's an example. You can find one still. Or also, he quotes extensively Noam John Pike, at the time and a hero of the time, and I put this famous cello of him. And the last extension is the extension of the visual beyond the indexical and the iconic. The computer is able to erase the division between what we feel and what we see. It is a parapsychological instrument for the direct projection of thoughts and emotions. When I read for the first time this line, I was thinking to the squid in Strange Days and the dream of this cinematic apparatus that provides directly neuronic impulses. The final statement is... Sorry. He quotes, of course, example are Belton. I just put here Belton because he has a long part on him. And the final statement is just the last line of the book. We are making a new world by making a new language. Through the art and technology of the expanded cinema, we shall create heaven right here on the heart, on the earth. Of course, this chaotic book reflects the 70s, the 60s, and the 70s. Nevertheless, reading this book and looking around, one of the greatest impression suggestion I can capture from this book is that basically the extension of the cinema today is reflecting the five great tracks detected by Gene Youngblood. In a certain sense, we can say that the current expansions follow the tracks envisioned by Youngblood. If cinema expands today, is first of all because the technological innovations. This is an IMAX, and this is a Dolby cinema. These innovations are mostly, I'd like to say, is more interested in intensity than in the revival of the attractions. What they are looking for is to address our senses in a more stronger way, to provoke our excitation, but not exactly in the sense, or not only in the sense in which early film was doing, according to Tom Gunning. This address of the senses is basically, focused on the idea of revamping or giving us back the intensity of a experience. This is a long parenthesis that I want to avoid. The idea that going back to the early film theories is exactly the essence of film, or the specificity of film, is not based on the technical apparatus, is based on what and how the technical apparatus is able to give us the sense of a full experience, say more, full modern experience. This idea of having back an experience because the involvement of our senses. The second path through which film tries to expand is on field is through a new models of production, and basically what is called grassroots practices. Basically, I do not know if you agree, but basically there are two main elements in the grassroots practices. On one side, the aesthetic of remix, and on the other side, the aesthetic of mashup that you quoted this morning. And the idea of this expansion through new model of practices is not just to get out of the traditional model of production and consumption. It's the idea of having in mind, or let's say fishing in a certain sense, in the gray sea of the images and sounds that surround us. Doesn't matter where they are, and does matter where they go. This is the logic of remix and mashups. Work on any possible kind of material. Just make, I mean, try to make as yours what you mean. The third track for the expansion of film today in this tentative portrait of what happens today, which is controversial, I'm sure, is the strong presence of the spectators' voices. Of course, always cinema has been connected with spectator voices. I just remind you that in the very beginning of Christian Metz's book, Cinema and Psychoanalysis, he speaks about three great machines. The first is the machine of production, how to produce a movie. The second is the machine of consumption, how to watch movies. And the third is the discursive machine of the film. And he says, that is a fantastic formulation. It's not just how to speak about movies. It's how to transform movies in a good object, in a psychoanalytical sense. So my idea is that from its inception, film has been always something connected with words. But this time, there is something a little bit, let's say, stronger. If you go to many of the usual websites devoted to the cinema, you can easily find, this is coming soon, you can easily find absolutely not balanced, but mixed, deeply mixed, a number of windows in through which you can get information about what happens, which is the next movie, where you can find, how to buy ticket, etc., etc. But also, institutionally, you can find a number, an impressive number of windows devoted to the voices of the spectators. It's not just the idea that you have two components. What I'm shocked about is the very fact that these two components are in the same space. And at the same time, cinema is a presentation, a showcase, but also is what everybody is able to say about that. It's the prolongation of the experience. And I can say a little bit basically with Marx that the consumption and the appropriation is the finish of the production process. The other track, largely studied by Henry Jenkins, I do not agree completely, but it's another story with him. But it's, for example, I was just a little parenthesis. I was struck by Francesca's speech because she get rid basically of Jenkins' category, and I'm very in depth with you about that. And the idea that there is no more, it's almost impossible to distinguish between the convergence culture in the hand of the industry and the participatory culture in the hands of the fan. It's not true. There is a superposition, a strong superposition, and there are practices that go quite beyond these kind of things. But anyway, if we take just this transmedia storytelling as something that is quite clear about the expansion of the movies through different media to spread, just to use the word of the last spreadable media, the last Jenkins book, just 1 month ago, you can find franchising like Pirates of Caribbean, that are not at all adaptation, etc., etc., etc. Just this one stage in a long path, and the beginning could be a thematic park, and the end could be doesn't matter where. And in fact, if you explore, for example, the Disney's website about Pirates of Caribbean, it's useful to understand how many things are under the same label. Video games, gadgets, instructional journeys, parties for 16-year-old boys. You can get what you want under this label. And finally, the last expansion of film is, of course, beyond the indexical. Once again, I do not want to, it takes too much time, whether or not the digital is opposite to the indexical. Basically, I think not. And John Belton wrote an excellent text on the false revolution of the digital many years ago, and since there I guess that I completely understood that this obsession of the reversal. No, I mean, the computer-generated imagery is not the opposite of the indexical. It's the indexical plus something else. Is the indexical open to the opposite or open to a larger field? Is not, I have to say to Lev Manovich, whose proposition was striking, the idea that the digital changes the inscription of cinema in another field instead of the indexical in another kind of field, the history of art field. I guess that computer-generated image is not something else, it's an extension that brings cinema to different and many other possibilities and many other paths. Second move, I'm a full professor, so I do not risk to lose my job. And moreover, I have a pension. So I'm quite quiet about that. But of course, I'm deeply affected with this existence of film, with I can say, like Sartre in one of most beautiful pages of its autobiography, says, "My age is almost the same of movies." I can say that my life has been always into the movies, or so I do not want to dismiss movies. But on the other side, I'm not obsessed. There are a lot of things that have been dismissed. At least three or four types of human being has been dismissed. I mean, and Homo sapiens is lost. Why not to lose movies? It's not a great problem, I mean. The question is not the death. It's the question of identity. And the question of identity is, are we speaking still of cinema, or we are speaking about something else, which we can say, we can call screened images? I like a couple, instead of cinematic, the screenic. Are we in a screenic regime? Or, put in another way, not because I want to go back to the idea of specificity, but let's say the specificity in the sense of identity, as John Belton via Altman quoted before. And I know that this identity is not stable, is never stable. But there is an identity for movies. Or put in another way, the third way, there is any otherness in front of which film cinema can say, can claim that is not, is what it is compared with this otherness. Because specificity was the idea that cinema is what other media are not. But in the screenic regime, there is an otherness to which the film, the cinema could fight, against which the cinema could fight. Let me answer the question through, this is my third point, through the idea that there are a lot of what I call strategies of self-assertion in the movies today. Strategies that are focused on the idea of establishing an identity. Maybe a new identity, but anyway, an identity. Many of them, they affect the social life of film, and many, on the contrary, they affect the very nature of the images. Let's start with the strategies of self-assertion that affect the social life of film. If you go in the websites of festival, Criterion Collection, archives, etc., it's easy to find an attempt to define through the definition of the aim of the festival, to define the new territory of the film. But a new territory that is legitimated to be a filmic territory. The aim of the festival is to raise awareness and promote the various aspects of international cinema in all its form. Everything. We are ready for everything. As art, entertainment, industry, in a spirit of freedom dialogue. We are ready to go in the screening regime. The festival also organizes a retrospective and tributes the major figure as a contribution toward a better understanding of the history of cinema. This is a fantastic strategy of self-affirmation. Open to everything, but the king must be this one. The booklet of the Academy Museum of Motion Picture, which is one of the future projects of the Academy in the future, it's absolutely great. The significance of the movies has always been a constant, but industry itself is undergoing a dramatic change. Digital technologies, etc., etc. While motion picture and storytelling will endure and thrive, documenting and curating the art, craft, and science of the movies is now more important than ever. Criterion Collection is responding the same logic, etc., etc. The most most perturbative, may I say so, is the New Zealand. We are ready to take everything. Short film, documentary, feature film, home movies, newsreel, TV programs, and advertising. This is the point in which the strategies of self-affirmation is really challenging the extreme border of the identity. There is another way in the strategies of self-assertion. Another book, not far from same decade, but still terribly useful to be read, is Marshall McLuhan's book. As you remember, it proposes the idea of hot medium and opposed as cold medium. And to him, film is defined as not only film, but there is one thing clear in definition of movies is the very fact that it's an hot medium, which means high intensity in the sensorial components. McLuhan is not, I do not know, maybe he read more than I suppose, but he never quotes, is not aware that the definition of movies as experience, as intense experience, as experience based on intensity of the senses, is exactly one of the great lines of the early film theorists. Epstein, in this Magnification, which is a wonderful text, you can read it. Bella Ballatz, another key text in which the closeness evoked by McLuhan is clearly defined with this fantastic, the idea of the naturalism of love. That's a sentence that I really like. Papini, in one of the early texts, 1907, they give the impression of reality far better than scenery and backdrop of Honey. This intensity that is also insisted in the same article by Papini through the evocation of darkness opposed to the light, the true light, the strong light, as opposed to the darkness of the film, as opposed to the darkness of the theater. And eventually, in my list, Ricciotto Canudo. What I want to say is that the second strategy of self-assertion goes through the idea of the film as the more intense medium appealing the senses. And in this sense, of course, we can read 3D, for example. That was clear in the first 3D explosion, 1952-54. In the rebirth of 3D, Avatar 2009, there was a sort of fake conscience, the idea, oh, okay, 3D is on movies, but we are ready to give the 3D to television, cell phone, etc. Frankly, didn't happen. And still, film is defining the theatrical experience as basically based on the challenge and pleasure of an intense provocation of senses. Few images about Avatar could provide an homage. Cameron is it's real. I've seen that he gifted the machine to go to the deep depth of the sea for scientific purposes. But it's exactly that, the intensity of the and the provocation and the address of the senses. It's also true that today's film is, for sure, on one side an expanded cinema, remix, strategy of remix, mashup, etc., is, second instance, an intense and immersive experience, 3D, but I take 3D as an epitome. It's not only in 3D. 3D is symptomatic of a certain way of film to self-assert itself. But it's also true that today, film is working intensively with poor images. There is a strong component of low definition in film, and my question is, why that? Is this move contradicting the self-assertion of the film as intense experience? I know that a few months ago you had here Ito Sterl, whose text for Chris Masker conference. Her text in defense of the poor image is now one of the most quoted text, and I will do that. The characterization of poor image is also very poetic. The poor image is a copy in motion. Its quality is bad. Its resolution substandard. It's accelerated. It deteriorates. It's a ghost of an image, a preview, a thumbnail, an errant idea, etc., etc., etc. This idea that they are the lumpen proletariat of the images, and they are the images circulating around, but images that film could capture and use. Farocchi is exemplary on this side. The strong work he does with poor images, the way in which he works with these poor images, both in his film and in his installations. Poor images that come from surveillance camera, cell phones, handheld devices, etc., etc., etc. But poor images are also the images that lost their own quality because coming from the past. And let me quote Janikian and Ricci Lucchi, the two filmmakers, not because I'm Italian, just because I have to say that I really love their work, in which the old prints that lost their quality are retaken and rescreened in another way. Both as a form of polemical gesture or as a form of nostalgia, poor images come back to the movies. Why that? Reading Marshall McLuhan is once again useful, because his move is not just to define hot media as opposed to the cool media, but to define the change of temperature that happens in media. Media change temperature. Hot media could become hotter or could be cooling down. And also, this cooling down and this hotting is very often tied with the context in which that happens. They reverse. They temperature, but they do that on one side because we have different ages, and for example, according him, the age that start in the 70s, the age of television, of computer, is a cool age, not a hot age like the age of the print. So the first reason is because film must adapt the new temperature that are surrounding us. Film must adapt itself to a context in which staying or trying to keep its identity to the new temperature that define the images today, which is the circulating poor images. But also there is a second reason in this, or let's say, the second aspect of the second reason, of this reason, is that according McLuhan, when a medium cool down or hot up, especially when it cools down, it freezes hybrid energies. And these hybrid energies that are released, they are able to provide a good reason to get out from the trance and numbness that media impose us. They are able to give us back the forgotten last chapter of the first part of McLuhan, in which there is really an autoimmune paradigm. It says, media cooling down, they could provide an awareness that make possible to face the inundation of media, the mediated world. So providing an awareness. I can say in another way that through the adoption of the poor images, on one side, film cinema adapts itself to the new era, but on the other side, it's providing an awareness about what images are. Could provide a political critique of the movies. In another way, could become hot, not on the side of senses, but on the side of consciousness. Hot consciousness, high definition in the sense of consciousness. It's from this point of view that I like to distinguish cinema of expansion, all over on the risk of losing itself in the great sea of what I can call the general discursivity, the cinema of immersion, try to preserve its traditional identity, the appeal to the senses, and cinema of awareness, trying to use the images that comes from outside, trying to appropriate the images coming from outside, and giving back an awareness, giving us back in the autoimmune paradigm the vaccine to resist the inundation of media. These three cinemas that have different strategies, but sometimes they try to be connected each with other, are today, to me, what defines the field of cinema. Let me say that it's a triplet that is deeply whirling. We have the expansion, we have this movement of finding itself, its own territory, the moving to go to the awareness against the immersion, and this awareness means to be or to use the images that exactly are the images of expansion. There is a circularity between expansion, the need of an identity, the identity of I definition at the intellectual level, and going back to become, through the poor images, a field open to the otherness. I want to end up, and I challenge your passions with this idea to remain or to become cinema, the strategies through which dramatically film try to say, yes, I'm still cinema, not because I am, but because I remain or I want to become cinema, through a short clip, is the beginning of the Valley of Elan. Thank you.
Uncle Mike! Mike, get back in the fucking vehicle! Let's go, Mike, now!
We are watching the poor... Sorry. We are watching the poor images taken with the cell phone that the son of the main character sent to the father. And the father obsessively looks at these images because the son came back from Iraq, but now is dead. And he tries to understand what happens there and why he has been killed, likely at the end of the film, by his comrade. These poor images are punctuating this film until the end. When, in the moment in which the main character accepting the death of his son, understands what happened in Iraq. He is in his car and is thinking of these images, and his memory goes back to the sequence of the short film that we have seen at the very beginning.
Hello, Boner. There's your family.
Stop fucking around.
Hey! It's my fucking phone. Fuck you. You could have broken it.
You're a fucking idiot. Oh, fuck.
Oh, shit.
Do not stop. Do not fucking stop.
What do I do?
Speed up!
This is the image in which I see film reappropriating its capacity to give us the quality of the vision. This is the image in which I see the capacity of film to say, I can be again cinema. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was wonderful and exciting. And my question would start at this exactly image. So I would like to add, maybe potentially see what you think about one more dimension, right, to your triad, which is not just indexical plus, but indexical plus, 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 which is capture, right?
Yeah.
Think about Google Glass, which will be here, you know, in a half a year, right? Exactly the dream of the 60s. Everybody is wearing a capture device, right? Capturing everything, analyzing and transmitting it. And again, if I go back to my question about YouTube, right? Yes, people edit films, we create films, wonderful films, bad films, but the films are just island on top of this universe of billions and billions captured clips. So for whatever reasons, today, right, our culture is about capturing all the experiences, surveillance, YouTube, this, and the preferred mode of capture experience is audiovisual. Yes, you know, we have GPS, but it's not as primal. Yes, the computers capture our writing, but this happens kind of behind our backs. But the way we interact with reality in each other through capture. So I would say with capture, you can call it indexical, is where I think cinema kind of foundation is now. And so to me, yes. This is very much connected to this image.
Thank you so much, Lev. My answer is no. In the sense that for sure the capturing is in the culture of the audiovisual today, is in the culture of the screening. But in the culture of the filmic, now it seems to me the capture is no more sufficient, is no more enough. Movies, in order to self-assert it themselves, they may do something else, which is either provided a sort of, in a certain sense, they have to do something that in psychoanalytical terms is a secondarization. They must provide a moment in which either the intensity of the experience blows at the extreme, or the moment in which the self-awareness of media are and images are today. So to me, film, in order to get out of this destiny of being just into the screening, has to make one supplementary step. And is exactly what movies has done, I guess, for a long time. Provide an experience which was at the same time intense, but open to the awareness. Open to... This is the reason why, in putting another way, film has been the only medium able to reunite what Benjamin found a split, the Erfahrung and the Erlebnis, the self-consciousness and the intensity. Let me say, sorry, just one thing. I didn't have time, but just for the pleasure of cinephilia. I think that In the Valley of Elah is a pure remake of Muriel by Alain René. Because the story is absolutely the same. But the difference is that we see the poor images in Muriel, but at the end of the film, instead of re-inscribing these poor images into this second step, the main character throw out the camera and put fires in the home movies. So Muriel is a moment in which cinema doesn't need strategies of self-assertion. It's cinema. Now it seems to me that it needs to underline that it is cinema, that it could become cinema, that it could remain or could remain cinema. Sorry. Okay, thank you.
Is this on? I want to come back to this issue of the poor images, because a lot of your discussion has been about images, and especially the return of the poor image to early cinema. And I'll take that point, but it seems that one thing that you didn't discuss and that has developed in an enormous way in the last several decades is a high technology of sound. The fact that you can have poor images, and a lot of the examples that you showed of the poor images had absolutely fabulous sound that captures in an effective way, and in all of the ways that you were talking about, actually, the subject watching the film, so that it's not about the image, or let's just say, the experience isn't as dependent on the image as it was prior to this moment.
I completely agree with you, and it's a weakness. I have some difficulty of thinking of sound. First, I do not hear very well. Second, I live with my wife and my daughter that are fond of music, and they hear music all the day. Could be a psychoanalytical move to, I do not want to open my ear. But you are right, of course. I just devoted one image to the Dolby sound. But today, the intensity of the experience is mostly not only visual, but also acoustic. Absolutely right. And on this point of view, I'm interested in understanding things in which way that came to the cinema. This is a question for Barbara. Came to the cinema through the Dolby at home. So first was the way in which it has been improved from the point of view of the sound, the screening in the home theater. Then it became a sort of of a stable feature in the movies. Even though, I mean, technically, it was first but it was the home that made the habit of having this intensity, or that create the need of this intensity. But I'm not sure. It's your topic.
I'd like to pick up on the poor image and what you mentioned with Steyerl. And of course, Steyerl and the sort of valorization of the poor image from earlier theories of the shoddy photograph. But very important for Steyerl, as you pointed out in your citation of her, are the politics of the poor image that she picks up from Fanon. And in your move from the shoddy image in this last part of your paper to the celebration again of the cinematic, I mean, I wanted to loop my question back to the ending of Mark's paper earlier with Bart and the idea of the politics of form. So I'm wondering then, are the politics only to be found in the shoddy image then, and are become just pure, the image becomes pure aesthetics then in self-affirmation of the cinematic?
Thank you. I'm really in debt for this question because Meta read the entire paper and I cut exactly, maybe with the wrong move, I cut exactly this component. This idea of a political economy of images basically tied with Farocchi, of course. That is the most obvious example. And I want to develop a comparison between Farocchi and De Palma, redacted as two ways of, different ways of doing a political economy of images. From this point of view, if I can add something, which is another section of, is the same section that I cut in my, I'm interested not only in the, in the move by Steyerl about the Lumpenproletariat, which is a poetic image, is a poetic move, but I'm interested, frankly, in Rancière and the distribution of the sensible. And I, but I'm sorry, I didn't develop that. It is in the paper, but I cut because I wasn't sure. But maybe you can provide fantastic suggestion. To me, basically, the three cinemas I mentioned, the cinema of expansion correspond in Rancière distribution of sensible to the form of democracy in a global era. Everything is accessible to everything else. The cinema of immersion correspond to another form of democracy, the democracy of the elderly, the democracy of the best of the people, which is the Plato idea. The third is the cinema of awareness, the philosopher, the democracy of philosopher. The cinema of immersion corresponds to another form of democracy, is the democracy of fusion, is the fusional democracy. We are accessing, everybody's accessing something which is not accessible to the other. I do not know if I'm clear. So I'm sorry, it's a very sketch, but just to say that I'm very, very attentive to this aspect. I do not forget that. And to me, on the contrary, it was a substantial part of what I'm thinking about the being back cinema.
I love, by the way, what you're saying here, but I have a specific question. You know, there's a degree to which film literacy is a constantly evolving sophistication. The fact that we're able to read poor images for what they are very quickly sometimes, or when they don't want us to read what a poor image represents, we're thrown into a level of wait and see where the contextualization takes place so we can understand it. makes this whole kind of understanding of imagery now a much more sophisticated process. There was a Chilean film just finished last year called No, which adapted a look to it which frustrated audiences because they couldn't read it.
Yeah.
They didn't understand the codification of it. There's another film at Sundance this year about called Chess Fever, which was actually shot like it was a 1960s video port-a-pack. And that was also equally frustrating for audiences because they found it as a barrier. So I find it interesting to kind of analyze the way in which film literacy is itself being coded and understood and evolving. And in a way that young audiences seem to have an awareness of, that's almost intuitive. They understand what that image means. Whereas one of my real memories is from 1962 or so, when I was 12 years old and my mother coming into the room and sitting down and watching television with me. And at a point, she said, "What's going on? What's going on?" And I said, "Mom, it's the commercial." and she didn't understand the shift that had taken place, because commercials weren't being coded that same way for what she was used to. And again, the literacy that I had was immediate, and for her it was no.
Yeah.
So I find it very interesting, this whole question of reading and language of images, that I think is really interesting.
Thank you so much. You're touching a real point. For an instructor as I am, on one side, it's true that we have to provide. Sometimes the sophistication is a form of legitimacy. You were absolutely clear in your lecture, and I agree on that. Sometimes it's a way of providing a knowledge that they do not have. But sometimes, and it's not a worry, it's a fantastic destiny to me, is that a lot of people, they do understand things immediately. And I take a lot of time to explain them what they instantly understand. But once again, I go back to Marx. And when I think about my job, I think that basically my duty is to understand what people are doing without understanding. Thank you so much.